I'm Kristen Marchand, and this is the Opiongo Line. I'm joined tonight by Jeff Bowman, Kathy Chepesky, Rob Filipkowski, and Lynn Stewart, all members of the Opiongo Readers Theatre. They're here to bring you a show entitled Buck Hill and Other Stories. It's our annual tip of the hat to all things spooky and things that go bump in the night just before Halloween. And for those locals who know something of the unique character of the Upper Madawaska and Opiongo River Valleys, you'll probably already know something about Buck Hill, a notoriously spooky place along the Bonnechere River where there are still sightings of strange things that have been going on near Round Lake for decades. So, if you think we only regale you with exotic stories from some faraway continent written hundreds of years ago by some long-dead white guy, know that tonight we plan to scare the bejeepers out of you with our very local story about very recent events. So recent, in fact, it's a story written exclusively for us, only this past month. But first, we thought we'd get you in the mood. And what better way than to remember those living between Maynooth and Mount St. Patrick, Douglas and Donegal, or indeed Killaloe and Barry's Bay? Put another way, we can always count on the local Irish to fire up our imaginations when it comes to ghosts, goblins, and ghouls. For instance, it was no accident that it was a fellow from Ireland, Bram Stoker, who wrote Dracula, published in 1897. Indeed, many of our local Irish think that ghosts, goblins, and ghouls are not merely a figment of someone's overactive imagination. We refer you now to a book entitled True Irish Ghost Stories, a sort of ancient scholarly compendium of all things really spooky. Here's Lynn Stewart with its most famous chapter.
Of all Irish ghosts, fairies, or bogles, the Banshee is the best known to the general public. Indeed, British and French visitors would class her with pigs, potatoes, and other fauna and flora of Ireland, and would expect her to make manifest her presence to them as being one of the sights of the country. She is a spirit with a lengthy pedigree. How lengthy? No man can say, as its roots go back into the dim, mysterious past. Avehill, the most famous banshee of ancient times, was attached to the kingly house of O'Brien. She haunted the rock of Craiglee above Killaloe, near the old palace of Kincora. In 1014 AD, the Battle of Clontarf was fought, and from which the aged king, Brian Boru, knew that he would never come away alive, for on the previous night, Avehill had appeared to him to tell him of his impending fate. The Banshee's method of foretelling death in olden times differed from that adopted by her at the present day. Now she wails and wrings her hands as a general rule, but in the old Irish tales, she is to be found washing human heads and limbs or blood-stained clothes till the water is all dyed with human blood, and this would take place before a battle. So it would seem that in the course of centuries her attributes and characteristics have changed somewhat. Very different descriptions are given of her personal appearance. Sometimes she is young and beautiful, sometimes old and of a fearsome appearance. One writer describes her as a tall, thin woman with uncovered head and long hair that floated round her shoulders, attired in something which seemed either a loose white cloak or a sheet thrown hastily about her, uttering piercing cries. Another person, a coachman, saw her one evening sitting on a stile in the yard. She seemed to be a very small woman with blue eyes, long light hair, and wearing a red cloak. By the way, it does not seem to be true that the Banshee exclusively follows families of Irish descent, for the last incident had reference to the death of a member of a County Galway family, English by name and origin. One of the oldest and best-known Banshee stories is that related in the Memoirs of Lady Fanshawe. In 1642, her husband, Sir Richard, and she chanced to visit a friend, the head of an Irish sept, who resided in his ancient baronial castle surrounded by a moat. At midnight, she was awakened by a ghastly and supernatural scream and, looking out of bed, beheld in the moonlight a female face and part of form hovering at the window. The distance from the ground, as well as the circumstance of the moat, excluded the possibility that what she beheld was of this world. The face was that of a young and rather handsome woman, but pale, and the hair, which was reddish, was loose and disheveled. the dress, which Lady Fanshawe's terror did not prevent her from remarking accurately, was that of the ancient Irish. This apparition continued to exhibit itself for some time, and then vanished with two shrieks similar to that which had first excited Lady Fanshawe's attention. In the morning, with infinite terror, she communicated to her host what she had witnessed, and found him prepared not only to credit, but to account for the superstition. "A near relation of my family," said he, "expired last night in this castle. We disguised our certain expectation of the event from you, lest it should throw a cloud over the cheerful reception which was your due. Before such an event happens in this family or castle, the female spectre whom you have seen is always visible. She is believed to be the spirit of a woman of inferior rank, whom one of my ancestors degraded himself by marrying, and whom afterwards, to expiate the dishonour done to his family, he caused to be drowned in the moat. In strictness, this woman could hardly be termed a banshee. The motive for the haunting is akin to that in the tale of the Scotch Drummer of Courtaquy, where the spirit of the murdered man haunts the family out of revenge and appears before death. Of course, there are many other historical stories about Irish banshees. Mr. T.J. Westrop, Master of Arts, has furnished the following. My maternal grandmother heard the following tradition from her mother, one of the Miss Ross Lewins, who witnessed the occurrence. Their father, Mr. Harrison Ross Lewin, was away in Dublin on law business, and in his absence, the young people went off to spend the evening with a friend who lived some miles away. The night was fine and lightsome as they were returning, save at one point where the road ran between trees or high hedges, not far to the west of the old church of Kilchrist. The latter, like many similar ruins, was a simple oblong building, with long side walls and high gables, and at that time it and its graveyard were unenclosed and lay in the open fields. As the party passed down the long dark lane, they suddenly heard in the distance loud keening and clapping of hands, as the country people were accustomed to do when lamenting the dead. The Ross Lewins hurried on, and came in sight of the old church, and saw near the side wall a little grey-haired old woman, clad in a dark cloak, running to and fro, chanting and wailing and throwing up her arms. The girls were very frightened, but the young men ran forward and surrounded the ruin, and two of them went into the church, the apparition vanishing from the wall as they did so. They searched every nook and found no one, nor did anyone pass out. All were now well scared and got home as fast as possible. On reaching their home, their mother opened the door and at once told them that she was in terror about their father, for as she sat looking out the window in the moonlight, a huge raven with fiery eyes lit on the sill and tapped three times on the glass. They told her their story, which only added to their anxiety, and as they stood talking, taps came to the nearest window, and they saw the bird again. A few days later, news reached them that Mr. Ross Lewin had died suddenly in Dublin. This occurred about 1776. Mr. Westrop also writes that the sister of a former Roman Catholic bishop told her sisters that when she was a little girl, she went out one evening with some other children for a walk. Going down the road, they passed the gate of the principal domain near the town. There was a rock or a large stone beside the road on which they saw something. Going nearer, they perceived it to be a little dark old woman who began crying and clapping her hands. Some of them attempted to speak to her, but got frightened, and all finally ran home as quickly as they could. Next day, the news came that the gentleman near whose gate the banshee had cried was dead, and it was found on inquiry that he had died at the very hour at which the children had seen the spectre. A lady who was a relation of one of the compilers, and a member of a County Cork family of English descent, sends the two following experiences of a banshee in her family. My mother, when a young girl, was standing looking out of the window in their house at Blackrock near Cork. She suddenly saw a white figure standing on a bridge, which was easily visible from the house. The figure waved her arms towards the house, and my mother heard the bitter wailing of the banshee. It lasted some seconds, and then the figure disappeared. Next morning, my grandfather was walking as usual into the city of Cork. He accidentally fell, hit his head against the curbstone, and never regained consciousness. In March 1900, my mother was very ill, and one evening the nurse and I were with her, arranging her bed. We suddenly heard the most extraordinary wailing, which seemed to come in waves around and under her bed. We naturally looked everywhere to try to find the cause, but in vain. The nurse and I looked at one another, but made no remark, as my mother did not seem to hear it. My sister was downstairs sitting with my father. She heard it, and thought some terrible thing had happened to her little boy, who was in bed upstairs. She rushed up and found him sleeping quietly. My father did not hear it. In the house next door, they heard it, and ran downstairs, thinking something had happened to the servant. But the latter at once said to them, "Did you hear the banshee? Mrs. P. must be dying." A few years ago, before 1894, a curious incident occurred in a public school in connection with the belief in the banshee. One of the boys, happening to become ill, was at once placed in a room by himself, where he was accustomed to sit all day. On one occasion, as he was being visited by the doctor, he suddenly started up from his seat and affirmed that he heard somebody crying. The doctor, who could hear or see nothing, of course came to the conclusion that the illness had slightly affected his brain. However, the boy, who appeared quite sensible, still persisted that he heard someone crying, and furthermore said, "It is the banshee, as I have heard it before." The following morning, the headmaster received a telegram saying that the boy's brother had been accidentally shot dead. That the banshee is not confined within the geographical limits of Ireland, but can follow the fortunes of a family abroad and therefore tell their death, is clearly shown by the following story. A party of visitors were gathered together on the deck of a private yacht on one of the Italian lakes, and during a lull in the conversation, one of them, a colonel, said to the owner, "Count, who's that queer-looking woman you have on board?" The count replied that there was nobody except the ladies present and the stewardess, but the speaker protested that he was correct, and suddenly, with a scream of horror, he placed his hands before his eyes and exclaimed, "Oh my God, what a face!" For some time he was overcome with terror, and at length reluctantly looked up and cried, "Ah, thank heavens it's gone!" "What was it?" asked the count. "Nothing human," replied the colonel, "nothing belonging to this world. It was a woman of no earthly type, with a queer-shaped, gleaming face, a mass of red hair, and eyes that would have been beautiful but for their expression, which was hellish. She had on a green hood, after the fashion of an Irish peasant." An American lady present suggested that the description tallied with that of the banshee, upon which the count said, "I am an O'Neill, at least I am descended from one. My family name is, as you know, Nelzini, which, little more than a century ago, was O'Neill. My great-grandfather served in the Irish Brigade, and on its dissolution at the time of the French Revolution, had the good fortune to escape the general massacre of officers, and in company with an O'Brien and a Maguire, fled across the frontier and settled in Italy. On his death, his son, who had been born in Italy, and was far more Italian than Irish, changed his name to Nelzini, by which name the family has been known ever since. But for all that, we are Irish." "Well, the banshee was yours, then," ejaculated the colonel. "What exactly does it mean?" "It means," the count replied solemnly, "the death of someone very nearly associated with me. Pray heaven it is not my wife or daughter." On that score, however, his anxiety was speedily removed, for within 2 hours he was seized with a violent attack of angina pectoris and died before morning. Mr. Elliot O'Donnell, to whose article on banshees we are indebted for the above, adds, "The banshee never manifests itself to the person whose death it is prognosticating. Other people may see or hear it, but the fated one never, so that when every one present is aware of it but one, the fate of that one may be regarded as pretty well certain."
That was Lynn Stewart reading about the Banshees of Ireland, who, if you must know, were known to have emigrated by the hundreds to the Ottawa Valley back in the 1840s, and who can still be heard, if not seen, should the right occasion present itself. Mind you, remember, if you hear a banshee tonight, you're safe. If you don't hear it, but everyone else around you does, might be time to order up your very own casket. Not all things, of course, that go bump in the night have the power to frighten us. Sometimes they can even make us smile. Here's a case in point, an article about a remote island near the New Brunswick, Maine border and published in the New York Sun newspaper on December 13, 1874. It was written by Edward Page Mitchell and is read by Rob Filipkowski.
We are permitted to make extracts from a private letter which bears the signature of a gentleman well known in business circles and whose veracity we have never heard called in question. His statements are startling and well-nigh incredible, but, if true, they are susceptible of easy verification. Yet the thoughtful mind will hesitate about accepting them without the fullest proof, for they spring upon the world a social problem of stupendous importance. The letter is dated at Pocock Island, a small township in Washington County, Maine, about 17 miles from the mainland, and nearly midway between Mount Desert and the Grand Manan. The last state census accords to Pocock Island a population of 311, mostly engaged in the porgy fisheries. At the U.S. presidential election of 1872, the island gave Grant a majority of 3. These 2 facts are all that we are able to learn of the locality from sources outside of the letter already referred to. The letter, omitting certain passages which refer solely to private matters, reads as follows. But enough of the disagreeable business that brought me here to this bleak island in the month of November. I have a singular story to tell you. After our experience together at Chittenden, I know you will not reject statements because they are startling. My friend, there is upon Pocock Island a materialized spirit which, or who, refuses to be dematerialized. At this moment, and within a quarter of a mile from me as I write, a man who died and was buried 4 years ago, and who has exploited the mysteries beyond the grave, walks, talks, and holds interviews with the inhabitants of the island, and is, to all appearances, determined to remain permanently upon this side of the river. I will relate the circumstances as briefly as I can. In April 1870, John Newbegin died and was buried in the little cemetery on the landward side of the island. Newbegin was a man of about 48, without family or near connections, and eccentric to a degree that sometimes inspired questions as to his sanity. What money he had earned by many seasons fishing upon the banks was invested in quarter shares of 2 small mackerel schooners, the remainder of which belonged to John Hodgson, the richest man on Pocock, who was estimated by good authorities to be worth $13,000 or $14,000. Newbegin was not without a certain kind of culture. He had read a good deal of the odds and ends of literature, and, as a simple-minded islander expressed it in my hearing, knew more bookfuls than anybody on the island. He was naturally an intelligent man, and he might have attained influence in the community had not it been for his utter aimlessness of character, his indifference to fortune, and his consuming thirst for rum. Many yachtsmen who have had occasion to stop at Pocock for water or for harbor shelter during eastern cruises will remember a long, listless figure, astonishingly attired in blue army pants, rubber boots, loose toga made of some bright chintz material, and very bad hat, staggering through the little settlement, followed by a rabble of jeering brats, and pausing to strike uncertain blows at those within reach of the dead sculpin which he usually carried round by the tail. This was John Newbegin. As I have already remarked, he died 4 years ago last April. The Mary Emmeline, one of the little schooners in which he owned, had returned from the eastward and had smuggled or run in a quantity of St. John brandy. Newbegin had a solitary and protracted debauch. He was missed from his accustomed walks for several days, and when the islanders broke into the hovel where he lived, close down to the seaweed, and almost within reach of the incoming tide, they found him dead on the floor, with an emptied demijohn hard by his head. After the primitive custom of the island, they interred John Newbegin's remains without coroner's inquest, burial certificate, or funeral services, and in the excitement of a large catch of porgies that summer, soon forgot him and his friendless life. His interest in the Mary Emmeline and the pretty boat recurred to John Hodgson, and as nobody came forward to demand an administration of the estate, it was never administered. The forms of law are but loosely followed in some of these marginal localities. Well, my dear, 4 years and 4 months had brought their quota of varying seasons to Pocock Island when John Newbegin reappeared under the following circumstances. In the latter part of last August, as you may remember, there was a heavy gale all along our Atlantic coast. During this storm, the squadron of the Naugatuck Yacht Club, which was returning from a summer cruise as far as Campobello, was forced to take shelter in the harbor to the leeward of Pocock Island. The gentlemen of the club spent 3 days at the little settlement ashore. Among the party was Mr. R.E., by which name you will recognize a medium of celebrity, and one who has been particularly successful in materializations. At the desire of his companions, and to relieve the tedium of their detention, Mr. E. improvised a cabinet in the little schoolhouse at Pocock, and gave a séance to the delight of his fellow yachtsmen, and the utter bewilderment of such natives as were permitted to witness the manifestations. The conditions appeared unusually favorable to spirit appearances, and the séance was, upon the whole, perhaps the most remarkable that Mr. E. ever held. It was all the more remarkable because the surroundings were such that the most prejudiced skeptic could discover no possibility of trickery. The first form to issue from the wood closet, which constituted the cabinet, when Mr. E. had been tied therein by a committee of old sailors from the aughts, was that of an Indian chief, who announced himself as Hockamock, and who retired after dancing a harvest moon pasul, and declaring himself in very emphatic terms as opposed to the present Indian policy of the administration. Hockamock was succeeded by the aunt of one of the yachtsmen, who identified herself beyond question by allusion to family matters and by displaying the scar of a burn upon her left arm, received while making tomato catsup upon earth. Then came successively a child whom none present recognized, a French-Canadian who could not talk English, and a portly gentleman who introduced himself as William King, the first governor of Maine. These in turn re-entered the cabinet and were seen no more. It was some time before another spirit manifested itself, and Mr. E. gave directions that the lights be turned down still further. Then the door of the wood closet was slowly opened, and a singular figure in rubber boots and a species of Dolly Varden garment emerged, bringing a dead fish in his right hand. The city men who were present, I am told, thought that the medium was masquerading in grotesque habiliments for the more complete astonishment of the islanders. But these latter rose from their seats and exclaimed with one consent, "It is John Newbegin!" And then, in not unnatural terror of the apparition, they turned and fled from the schoolroom, uttering dismal cries. John Newbegin came calmly forward and turned up the solitary kerosene lamp that shed uncertain light over the proceedings. He then sat down in the teacher's chair, folded his arms, and looked complacently about him. "You might as well untie the medium," he finally remarked. "I propose to remain in the materialized condition." And he did remain. When the party left the schoolhouse, among them walked John Newbegin, as truly a being of flesh and blood as any man of them. From that day to this, he has been a living inhabitant of Pocock Island, eating, drinking, water only, and sleeping after the manner of men. The yachtsmen, who made sail for Bar Harbor the very next morning, probably believed that he was a fraud hired for the occasion by Mr. E. But the people of Pocock, who laid him out, dug his grave, and put him in it 4 years ago, know that John Newbegin has come back to them from a land they know not of. The idea of having a ghost, somewhat more condensed, it is true, than the traditional ghost, as a member, was not at first over-pleasing to the 311 inhabitants of Pocock Island. To this day, they are a little sensitive upon the subject, feeling evidently that if the matter got abroad, it might injure the sale of the really excellent porgy oil, which is the product of their sole manufacturing interest. This reluctance to advertise the skeleton in their closet, superadded to the slowness of these obtuse, fishy, matter-of-fact people to recognize the transcendent importance of the case, must be accepted as explanation of the fact that John Newbegin's spirit has been on earth between 3 and 4 months, and yet the singular circumstance is not known to the whole country. But the Pocockians have at last come to see that a spirit is not necessarily a malevolent spirit, and accepting his presence as a fact in their stolid, unreasoning way, they are quite neighborly and sociable with Mr. Newbegin. I know that your first question will be, is there sufficient proof of his ever having been dead? To this, I answer unhesitatingly, yes. He was too well-known a character, and too many people saw the corpse to admit of any mistake on this point. I may add here that it was at one time proposed to disinter the original remains, but that project was abandoned in deference to the wishes of Mr. Newbegin, who feels a natural delicacy about having his first set of bones disturbed from motives of mere curiosity. You will readily believe that I took occasion to see and converse with John Newbegin. I found him affable and even communicative. He is perfectly aware of his doubtful status as a being, but is in hopes that at some future time there may be legislation that shall correctly define his position and the position of any spirit who may follow him into the material world. The only point upon which he is reticent is his experience during the 4 years that elapsed between his death and his reappearance at Pocock. It is to be presumed that the memory is not a pleasant one. At least he never speaks of this period. He candidly admits, however, that he is glad to get back to Earth and that he embraced the very first opportunity to be rematerialized. Mr. Newbegin says that he is consumed with remorse for the wasted years of his previous existence. Indeed, his conduct during the past 3 months would show that this regret is genuine. He has discarded his eccentric costume and dresses like a reasonable spirit. He has not touched liquor since his reappearance. He has embarked in the Porgy oil business, and his operations already rival that of Hodgson, his old partner in the Mary Emmeline and the Pretty Boat. By the way, Newbegin threatens to sue Hodgson for his individual quarter in each of these vessels, and this interesting case therefore bids fair to be thoroughly investigated in the courts. As a businessman, he is generally esteemed on the island, although there is a noticeable reluctance to discount his paper at long dates. In short, Mr. Newbegin is a most respectable citizen, if a dead man can be a citizen, and has announced his intention of running for the next legislature. And now, my dear, I have told you the substance of all I know respecting this strange, strange case. Yet, after all, why so strange? We accepted materialization at Chittenden. Is this any more than the logical issue of that admission? If the spirit may return to Earth, clothed in flesh and blood and all the physical attributes of humanity, why may it not remain on Earth as long as it sees fit? Thinking of it from whatever standpoint, I cannot but regard John Newbegin as the pioneer of a possibly large immigration from the spirit world. The bars once down, a whole flock will come trooping back to Earth. Death will lose its significance altogether. And when I think of the disturbance which will result in our social relations, of the overthrow of all accepted institutions, and of the nullification of all principles of political economy, law, and religion, I am lost in perplexity and apprehension.
That was Rob Filipkowski reading Edward Page Mitchell's Back from the Bourne about a ghost who at last report wanted to run for elected office. Come to think of it, we just had our own local municipal elections this past week. You may want to take special note of any new mayor or councillor who might be a little too transparent. You never know. Next up, we have a classic short story dealing with the macabre, if not the occult, by H.H. Monroe, or as he was better known by his pen name, Sacky. He had more than a little fun with people who sometimes, shall we say, have no trouble at all believing in things from the other side of reality. No, we're not talking Trumpers. Here is Jeff Bowman with The She-Wolf, a Sacky story you're not likely to forget.
Leonard Bilsiter was one of those people who have failed to find this world attractive or interesting, and who have sought compensation in an unseen world of their own experience or imagination, or invention. Children do that sort of thing successfully, But children are content to convince themselves and do not vulgarize their beliefs by trying to convince other people. Leonard Bilsiter's beliefs were for the few, that is to say, anyone who would listen to him. His dabblings in the unseen might not have carried him beyond the customary platitudes of the drawing room visionary if accident had not reinforced his stock in trade of mystical lore. In company with a friend who was interested in a Ural mining concern, he had made a trip across Eastern Europe at a moment when the great Russian railway strike was developing from a threat to a reality. Its outbreak caught him on the return journey somewhere on the further side of Perm, and it was while waiting for a couple of days at a wayside station in a state of suspended locomotion that he had made the acquaintance of a dealer in harness and metalware, who profitably whiled away the tedium of the long halt by initiating his English traveling companion in a fragmentary system of folklore that he had picked up from Trans-Baikal traders and natives. Leonard returned to his home circle, garrulous about his Russian strike experiences, but oppressively reticent about certain dark mysteries, which he alluded to under the resounding title of Siberian Magic. The reticence wore off in a week or two under the influence of an entire lack of general curiosity, and Leonard began to make more detailed allusions to the enormous powers which this new esoteric force, to use his own description of it, conferred on the initiated few who knew how to wield it. His aunt, Cecilia Hoops, who loved sensation perhaps rather better than she loved the truth, gave him as clamorous an advertisement as anyone could wish for by retelling an account of how he had turned a vegetable marrow into a wood pigeon before her very eyes. As a manifestation of the possession of supernatural powers, the story was discounted in some quarters by the respect accorded to Mrs. Hoop's powers of imagination. However divided opinion might be on the question of Leonard's status as a wonder worker or a charlatan, he certainly arrived at Mary Hampton's house party with a reputation for preeminence in one or other of those professions, and he was not disposed to shun such publicity as might fall to his share. Esoteric forces and unusual powers figured largely in whatever conversation he or his aunt had a share in, and his own performances, past and potential, were the subject of mysterious hints and dark avowals. "Oh, I wish you would turn me into a wolf, Mr. Bilsiter," said his hostess at luncheon the day after his arrival. "My dear Mary," said Colonel Hampton, "I never knew you had a craving in that direction." "A she-wolf, of course," continued Mrs. Hampton. "It would be too confusing to change one's sex as well as one's species at a moment's notice." "Well, I don't think one should jest on these subjects," said Leonard. "I'm not jesting. I'm quite serious, I assure you. Only don't do it today. We've only 8 available bridge players, and it would break up one of our tables. Tomorrow we shall be a larger party. Tomorrow night, after dinner." "In our present imperfect understanding of these hidden forces, I think one should approach them with humbleness rather than mockery," observed Leonard, with such severity that the subject was forthwith dropped. Clovis Sangrail had sat unusually silent during the discussion on the possibilities of Siberian magic. After lunch, he sidetracked Lord Pabham into the comparative solution of the billiard room and delivered himself of a searching question. "Have you such a thing as a she-wolf in your collection of wild animals? A she-wolf, moderately good temper?" Lord Pabham considered. "Well, there's Louisa," he said, "a rather fine specimen of the timber wolf. I got her 2 years ago in exchange for some Arctic foxes. Most of my animals get to be fairly tame before they've been with me very long. I think I can say Louisa has an angelic temper, as she-wolves go. Why do you ask?" "Well, I was wondering whether you would lend her to me for tomorrow night," said Clovis, with the careless solicitude of one who borrows a collar stud or a tennis racket. "Tomorrow night?" "Well, yes, wolves are nocturnal animals, so the late hours won't hurt her," said Clovis, with the air of one who has taken everything into consideration. "One of your men could bring her over from Pabham Park after dusk, and with a little help, he ought to be able to smuggle her into the conservatory at the same moment that Mary Hampton makes an unobtrusive exit." Lord Pabham stared at Clovis for a moment in pardonable bewilderment. Then his face broke into a wrinkled network of laughter. "Oh, that's your game, is it? You're going to do a little Siberian magic on your own account. And is Mrs. Hampton willing to be a fellow conspirator? Mary is pledged to see me through with it if you will guarantee Louisa's temper." "I'll answer for Louisa," said Lord Pabham. By the following day, the house party had swollen to larger proportions, and Bilsiter's instinct for self-advertisement had expanded duly under the stimulant of an increased audience. At dinner that evening, he held forth at length on the subject of unseen forces and untested powers. And his flow of impressive eloquence continued unabated while coffee was being served in the drawing room preparatory to a general migration to the card room. His aunt ensured respectful hearing for his utterances, but her sensation-loving soul hankered after something more dramatic than mere vocal demonstration. "Won't you do something to convince them of your powers, Leonard?" she pleaded. "Change something into another shape. He can, you know, if he only chooses to," she informed the company. "Oh, do," said Mavis Pellington earnestly, and her request was echoed by nearly everyone present. Even those who were not open to conviction were perfectly willing to be entertained by an exhibition of amateur conjuring. Leonard felt that something tangible was expected of him. "Has anyone present," he asked, "got a threepenny bit or some small object of no particular value? You're surely not going to make coins disappear or something primitive of that sort," said Clovis contemptuously. "I think it very kind of you not to carry out my suggestion of turning me into a wolf," said Mary Hampton, as she crossed over to the conservatory to give her macaws their usual tribute from the dessert dishes. "I have already warned you of the danger of treating these powers in a mocking spirit," said Leonard solemnly. "I don't believe you can do it," laughed Mary provocatively from the conservatory. "I dare you to do it if you can. I defy you to turn me into a wolf." As she said this, she was lost to view behind a clump of azaleas. "Mrs. Hampton," began Leonard with increased solemnity, but he got no further. A breath of chill air seemed to rush across the room, and at the same time the macaws broke forth into ear-splitting screams. "What on earth is the matter with those confounded birds, Mary?" exclaimed Colonel Hampton. At the same moment, an even more piercing scream from Mavis Pellington stampeded the entire company from their seats. In various attitudes of helpless horror or instinctive defense, they confronted the evil-looking gray beast that was peering at them from amid a setting of fern and azalea. Mrs. Hoops was the first to recover from the general chaos of fright and bewilderment. "Leonard," she screamed shrilly to her nephew, "turn it back into Miss Hampton at once. It may fly at us at any moment. Turn it back." I don't know how to," faltered Leonard, who looked more scared and horrified than anyone. "What?" shouted Colonel Hampton. "You've taken the abominable liberty of turning my wife into a wolf, and now you stand there calmly and say you can't turn her back again?" To do strict justice to Leonard, calmness was not a distinguishing feature of his attitude at the moment. "I assure you I didn't mean to turn Mrs. Hampton into a wolf. I didn't turn her into a wolf. Nothing was farther from my intentions," he protested. "Then where is she, and how came that animal into the conservatory?" demanded the colonel. "Of course, we must accept your assurance that you didn't turn Mrs. Hampton into a wolf," said Clovis politely, "but you will agree that appearances are against you." "Are we to have all these recriminations with that beast standing there ready to tear us to pieces?" wailed Mavis indignantly. "Lord Pabham, you know a good deal about wild beasts," suggested Colonel Hampton. "The wild beasts that I've been accustomed to," said Lord Pabham, "have come with proper credentials from well-known dealers, or have been bred in my own menagerie. I've never before been confronted with an animal that walks unconcernedly out of an azalea bush, leaving a charming and popular hostess unaccounted for. As one can judge from outward characteristics," he continued, "it has the appearance of a well-grown female of the North American timber wolf, a variety of the common species, Acanus lupus." "Oh, never mind its Latin name," screamed Mavis, as the beast came a step or two further into the room. "Can't you entice it away with food and shut it up where it can't do any harm?" "If it really is Mrs. Hampton, who's just had a very good dinner, I don't suppose food will appeal to it very strongly," said Clovis. "Leonard," beseeched Mrs. Hoops tearfully, "if this is none of your doing, can't you use your great powers to turn this dreadful beast into something harmless before it bites us all, a rabbit or something?" I don't suppose Colonel Hampton would care to have his wife turned into a succession of fancy animals as though we were playing a round of games with her, interposed Clovis. I absolutely forbid it, thundered the Colonel. Most wills I've had anything to do with have been inordinately fond of sugar, said Lord Pabham. If you like, I'll try the effect on this one. He took a piece of sugar from the saucer of his coffee cup and flung it to the expectant Louisa, who snapped it in midair. There was a sigh of relief from the company. A wolf that ate sugar, when it might at the least have been employed in tearing macaws to pieces, had already shed some of its terrors. The sigh deepened to a gasp of thanksgiving when Lord Pabham decoyed the animal out of the room by a pretended largesse of further sugar. There was an instant rush to the vacated conservatory. There was no trace of Mrs. Hampton except the plate containing the macaw's supper. "The door is locked on the inside," exclaimed Clovis, who had deftly turned the key as he affected to test it. Everyone turned towards Bilsiter. "If you haven't turned my wife into a wolf," said Colonel Hampton, "will you kindly explain where she has disappeared to, since she obviously could not have gone through a locked door? I will not press you for an explanation of how a North American timber wolf suddenly appeared in the conservatory, but I think I have some right to inquire what has become of Mrs. Hampton." Bilsiter's reiterated disclaimer was met with a general murmur of impatient disbelief. "I refuse to stay another hour under this roof," declared Mavis Pellington. "If our hostess has really vanished out of human form," said Mrs. Hoops, "none of the ladies of the party can very well remain. I absolutely decline to be chaperoned by a wolf." "Well, it's a she-wolf," said Clovis soothingly. The correct etiquette to be observed under the unusual circumstances received no further elucidation. The sudden entry of Mary Hampton deprived the discussion of its immediate interest. "Someone has mesmerized me," she exclaimed crossly. "I found myself in the game larder of all places, being fed with sugar by Lord Pabham. I hate being mesmerized, and the doctor has forbidden me to touch sugar." The situation was explained to her, as far as it permitted, of anything that could be called explanation. "Then you really did turn me into a wolf, Mr. Bilsiter," she exclaimed excitedly. But Leonard had burned the boat in which he might now have embarked on a sea of glory. He could only shake his head feebly. "It was I who took that liberty," said Clovis. "You see, I happen to have lived for a couple of years in northeastern Russia, and I have more than a tourist's acquaintance with the magic craft of that region. One does not care to speak about these strange powers, but once in a while, when one hears a lot of nonsense being talked about them, one is tempted to show what Siberian magic can accomplish in the hands of someone who really understands it. And I yielded to that temptation. May I have some brandy? The effort has left me rather faint." If Leonard Bilsiter could at that moment have transformed Clovis into a cockroach and then have stepped on him, he would gladly have performed both operations.
That was Jeff Bowman reading H.H. Monroe's The She-Wolf. Now for the main course. It's not often we get to tell a ghost story about things close to home, but tonight we have such a treat. It involves two very famous local places, Red's, which is down by Killaloe, and Buck Hill, near Round Lake. For those of you who don't believe in ghosts, well, we'd encourage you to take a midnight ride this Halloween and go out along the Simpsons Pit Road, bang a right before you arrive in Round Lake Center, and see what you can see. Here's Kathy Chepesky with Doubting Thomas, a short story written by, well, we'd rather not say. He's a tad shy, but we can tell you he does have white hair, and he never talks about Shakespeare.
His middle name was Thomas. It was the only name he felt comfortable with. It had been given to him in memory of his uncle, in the same way his Christian name was Irish to commemorate his mother's family. And his family name was an anglicized version of his father's German bloodline. Still, it was his middle name, Thomas, that he felt most at home with. And though no one called him that until high school, it was the only name he ever thought proper for himself. It had nothing to do with his uncle. His preference had come from when the priest read a gospel about Doubting Thomas. It intrigued him how someone could refuse to believe anything until he saw it with his own eyes, touched it with his own hands. If that was good enough for St. Thomas, thought the boy when he was only 12 years old, it's good enough for me. So ever since that Sunday in Our Lady of Angels Church in Brudenell, Thomas saw himself as the rightful heir to an ancient skepticism that he believed his namesake had wanted him to pursue. It was a belief that would cost him dearly. Doubting became such a consistent habit of mind that as Thomas grew older, it seemed at times to paralyze him with an inability to act, to decide, to make up his mind. Yet at other times, it was a habit that showered him with certain rewards. When other children were easily duped into believing something, Thomas refused and was more often than not proven right. So much so that it was common to hear his name conjoined with that saintly adjective that stirred his own giddy self-worth. Doubting Thomas was the appellation he soon became known by. Not so much as a nickname, but as his true identity. It drove some of his teachers to frustration in having to explain the consecutive reasoning that lay beneath almost every assumption they tried to pass off to him in class. In fact, by the time he reached high school, his reputation for doubting almost everything that anybody in a position of authority asserted had preceded him. "So you must be doubting Thomas," asked his homeroom teacher the first day he entered Madawaska Valley District High School. "Or perhaps it's just doubtful Thomas?" That sort of sarcasm Thomas let roll off him like water off a duck. He believed there was no need to fight anything but the really important battles. And he alone would choose the time and place of those battles. Thomas would often say nothing if chided by such probing teachers. His classmates from Brudenell who knew him well often murmured their old recognition of the false pride that some new teacher felt upon first encountering Thomas. His classmates knew their friend would only seem to acquiesce, seem to submit to the conventional wisdom and authority of that teacher, until one day Thomas would raise his hand after weeks, sometimes months of silence, and ask that one embarrassing question or introduce that singular confounding fact that left the authority of conventional wisdom in tatters. He was quiet and unassuming, some might even say shy. Nothing in his appearance told of his burning desire to know the truth of just about everything. In fact, he seemed genuinely disappointed when he asked those embarrassing questions or produced that one confounding fact, and the conventional wisdom of the classroom simply went up in smoke. Still, Thomas was not the master of his own fate. There was one, his grade 11 teacher of English literature, who seemed to understand the boy, who seemed to plumb the depths of that unusual quietude, and who seemed to share his doubt about the limits of human knowledge. "I want you to write a 1,500-word essay on a single line in Hamlet," that grade 11 English teacher said to Thomas, after the boy had pointed out some doubtful assertion in Shakespeare's famous play. "It's the line where Hamlet tells his best friend, 'There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy.'" Thomas accepted the assignment. He knew exactly what he would do. His essay would have little to do with Hamlet and everything to do with Red's, an old abandoned farmhouse near Killaloe. It was a place everybody swore was haunted by a red, devilish ghost. It was swarmed every autumn with high school students with freshly minted driver's licenses and banged-up old half-ton trucks and bottles of lemon gin and giddy girlfriends who wanted to be frightened, if only to rush into the waiting arms of some handy protector. It was a place that had all the makings of misbelief for most people, but not for Thomas. He had gone to Red's only twice, but he had figured out what was really going on. The first time, he lay in wait one Friday night in late October, waiting with some friends and watching as some of the girls eventually got bored as nothing was happening. The lemon gin had run out, and still there was no sign of any ghost. The girls said they were getting cold and just wanted to go home. And so one half-ton after another turned on their ignitions and poured out of the pasture that ran along the ridge opposite the old farmhouse. Haunted, everyone said, because of some murder that nobody could remember the exact details of, but which everybody swore they knew had definitely happened. It was only then, after a few of those old trucks had pulled onto the dirt road and headed back to Killaloe in the opposite direction, that the ghost appeared. Far off in the darkness, the old farmhouse lit up from inside, but not with ordinary light. Rather, it was a curious red light that strobed in devilish ways. It only lasted a few seconds each time, and might happen only half a dozen times during certain nights, but once anyone saw it, it was something never to be forgotten. It scared the daylights out of most teenagers to their very core. And there was the rub. That was the reason people kept coming back. Half the folks who showed up for a Friday night stakeout would leave only to hear the next day about what had happened at Red's just after they had left. And so they were back again the following weekend. It was a ghost, if not the devil sure shooting, everybody said. That strange red flickering light was definitely a signal that the ghost or devil or whatever it was giving off a deadly warning to keep everybody away. It took all of 10 minutes for Thomas to sort out the truth. Red's was nothing more than an optical illusion. The following Saturday, he went back to the old farm a second time and entered the abandoned farmhouse. He saw the windows had all been broken, every sash bereft of any glass except for a few jagged shards. But then he spotted an old bedroom mirror and a chandelier broken and hanging akimbo. He knew that curious prism-like combination was reflecting the red taillights of the half-ton trucks as they left. The teacher gave him an A for his proof that there are some things between heaven and earth that are thought to be beyond the limits of philosophy or science, but that are really not. They are simply delusions, Thomas had argued successfully. Ideas held by the feeble-minded, the naive, the young, and sometimes the slightly inebriated. Still, his teacher had added a strange postscript to his grade. Wonder if your doubtful philosophy holds true for Buck Hill? Thomas had heard about Buck Hill, another haunted old abandoned log cabin near Round Lake. Apparently, late in the 1930s, at the height of the Great Depression, a teamster was laid off and returned to his log cabin that he had built halfway up Buck Hill next to his failed 100-acre farm that was mostly brush and pasture land. He had a small garden that his wife and 7-year-old daughter tended, and along with the fish he caught along the Bonshire River and the venison he shot every autumn in and around Buck Hill, he had made ends meet. But that year, everybody said it was the late winter of 1938, he had been let go from his regular job at a lumber camp on the Opiongo after his 2 horses had drowned crossing Victoria Lake. There was no work for him, and so he came home to figure out what he might do next. March ended that year less like a lamb and more like a lion, and so by the time he stepped up on his front porch, there was a terrible blizzard raging, and it had all but shut down life outside and inside his farmhouse. There was barely any coal oil left in the hurricane lantern that hung over the kitchen table. There was little heat left in the stove, and even the water pail by the sink had started to congeal a thick layer of ice. His wife and daughter were asleep, huddled together in bed, hidden beneath a threadbare Hudson Bay blanket and a patchy black bearskin that almost passed for a buffalo robe, but only held in half their body heat. Trooper, their hound dog, was shivering under the bed and looked as though he hadn't been fed in days. Upon entering the cabin, the teamster took no time at all to figure out what he needed to do. Quickly, he retraced his steps outside to the woodshed and brought in an armful of firewood and started up the fire again, in hopes of heating the whole place in a matter of minutes. Quickly, he then left for a second load of wood, but somehow in all his hurry, the wind must have undid the front door latch, and once he had entered the woodshed, that front door of the cabin was blown wide open. Before he returned, Trooper had escaped, hungry for anything the surrounding bush might give him for a meal, and the little 7-year-old girl had decided to chase after the dog or go looking for her dad. Nobody ever figured out which. In all the confusion amidst the swirling snow now inside the cabin, the man became distracted, first discovering his wife now standing, broom in hand, delirious with diphtheria, and fighting the wind wildly as it quickly drifted a foot of snow beneath the table. Suddenly, all went black as the unrelenting wind extinguished the hurricane lantern and put out the fire in the stove. It took more than a precious few minutes to get his bearings, but before he did, the blizzard outside left the dog and the little girl engulfed in such disorienting whiteness that they were never found. His wife died about a week later, and the teamster, he eventually went mad. Long before local teenagers had been duped by Reds, the tragedy of that night on Buck Hill had been passed down through generations. So, too, were the stories of mysterious lights that were sometimes seen near that old Buck Hill farm, long abandoned. Thomas had heard about those lights, small, about the size of baseballs, sometimes yellow, sometimes orange, sometimes green, all seeming to float through the forest near Buck Hill. Sometimes they quickly moved towards anyone who was lucky enough to see them. Sometimes they would move upwards towards the tree canopy, sometimes down towards the dirt road. Sometimes they'd just dance along the old rusted and broken barbed wire between the fence posts, or out beyond where the garden once was tilled, towards the edge of the dark and foreboding roar of the pine forest. There was even talk of people seeing the little girl, or what seemed like a little girl, something in a white sleeping gown that trailed and fluttered with a strange iridescent light that shone from within. It had a head full of white hair, but nobody had ever seen its face. And though a few had seen what they believed was Trooper, or at least a hound dog looking gaunt and still starving, many said it was really a timber wolf who always escorted whatever it was in that white sleeping gown. Thomas, of course, believed none of it. And though there was no essay involved, he couldn't help but take up his English teacher's challenge. To Thomas, there had to be a rational explanation for it all. And so, late that Indian summer near the end of October, he told his parents he was spending the night with his cousin in Killaloo. Instead, he took his old half-ton that his father had given him to go to high school in Barry's Bay and drove out along the Simpson Pit Road. He parked it about half a mile from the abandoned farmhouse on the Buck Hill Road. Just before sunset, he walked up the dirt driveway until he saw what remained of the old log cabin, now with most of its roof fallen in and overgrown with lilacs and larches. Indeed, a singular larch had somehow sprouted from the dirt floor in the middle of the kitchen and had grown nearly 80 feet through an opening in the roof. Thomas passed through the open front door and sat by the larch. There was an old wooden chair good enough to sit on, though one of its legs had been wired to withstand reasonable weight. He sat there for more than a few hours. It had been early evening when Thomas first entered the cabin, and even after darkness fell, the moon still provided enough light to see the original cupboards and sideboard that were strangely left intact. Curiously, there was a huge double-sided axe that had been thrust into what remained of the ceiling. It looked as though it might never be removed. It was riven so deeply into the timbers overhead. Hanging on one of the lower branches of the larch was an old hurricane lantern with a little coal oil still remaining. Thomas had brought his own flashlight, but decided not to turn it on. Rather, he just sat there, letting the night overtake him. He wasn't afraid as much as he was vigilant, constantly looking about him, wondering how things might be explained rationally. Nothing much happened until the moon went down about 3 in the morning. Shortly afterwards, Thomas saw the first of 3 lights outside, a soft green light as if somebody was swinging a lantern gently to and fro. Then came an orange light, and finally a yellow light. They seemed like 3 coal oil lanterns being carried a few hundred yards inside the forest, so he got up and walked outside towards them. There was no fear in his mind or heart. He simply wanted to find out the truth. As he passed through the farmyard and walked out beyond the old woodshed and what must have once been the little garden, he thought he could see something moving beyond the lanterns. And he then heard a strange rustling as though someone was walking in an old-fashioned dress. He stopped to listen more intently. Nothing. He started walking softly again, again hearing the crunch of autumn leaves beneath his feet mixed with the soft rustling of a dress. As he reached the edge of the dark pine forest, gently roaring with a light wind, the 3 lanterns, now about 100 feet from him but still swinging gently behind countless pine trees, suddenly they converged into one to form a singular kaleidoscope of green, orange, and yellow. A single light now seemed to emanate from one lantern, but it shifted to at least 3 differently colored lights, all seemingly swinging as if in unison, as though that lantern was being pitched gently to and fro. It had a strange rhythm to it. Thomas imagined someone might be singing. Before that thought had taken hold of his mind for more than a moment, he heard someone singing. The voice of a gentle girl, almost whispering a song to herself. That happy home is altered now. My father silent treads the shore, and sorrow marks the careworn brow where peace so tranquil reigned before. This grief and joy strangely blended, birth succeeding death so soon, and thus the round lake ball was ended with a journey to the tomb. As the song died out, Thomas just as suddenly saw the light run up to him and then felt something cold on his hand as it was outstretched in hopes of touching what seemed to be a white flowing gown. But as it quickly swirled around him, he felt nothing to his touch, though he could still hear the gown rustling and even growing strangely louder. Simply, his hand kept passing through not only the white flowing material, but through whatever strange iridescent light was inside it. He was still not afraid. Yet as the white gown completely enveloped him, it then seemed to tighten and yet slow itself, as if in slow motion. Still, he could sense no cloth touching him, but saw only out of the top folds of that gown a head lifting slowly towards his face, rising to within inches of him. With one hand, it brushed its long white hair away from its forehead at the same time as it lifted a lantern to reveal its own face, at once angelic and yet hideous, old and yet young, ultimately with 2 exquisitely tender brown eyes, expressive of such infinite sadness and eternal despair that it suddenly struck Thomas as if a penknife had stabbed his own heart. It was only then that he felt a peculiar, yet fragrant and warm breath slowly inch along his face, and then there was nothing but absolute darkness and dead silence. When he returned to high school about a month later, his English teacher would ask no more questions of him, nor did his classmates. Everyone knew Doubting Thomas was no more. The hair on his head, once black as night, had turned to an ashen white, eyebrows included. His eyes, too, seemed to have changed from their once pellucid blue to a strange shade of iridescent green, sometimes tinged with shards of yellow and orange if he stood for long at home in the Brudenell twilight. He never spoke again of Shakespeare.
That was Kathy Chepesky reading Doubting Thomas. If you want to hear something really spooky, you know that song Kathy was just singing near the end of the story? Well, it's taken from The Round Lake Ball, and it's from an old local manuscript written in 1869. We kid you not. In fact, next time you're in the public library in Killaloe, just ask to see a copy. It'll shiver your timbers. I'm Kristen Marchand, and for Jeff Bowman, Kathy Chepesky, Rob Filipkowski, Lynn Stewart, and our white-haired producer, Barry Conway, we'd like to wish you a very scary Halloween. Good day, and God bless.